තෙරුවන් සරණයි. Tirwan Sarnai, you should be able to hear me now on the web radio. But before we continue, let's just make sure that that is the case. If you could please check and confirm that you are able to hear me either on the web radio or on Skype, that would be most helpful. You can drop a message on Skype to say that you can hear me. If not, then I'm going to type a message on here as well. So we're live on the web radio now. Please drop me a message on Skype or on the web radio to confirm that you can hear me, and then we'll get started. Okay, great. I've just had someone confirm that they're able to hear me on the web radio. So that's the go flag for me. We'll get started. This week we're only streaming via the web radio, which is usually better because there are no distractions, unlike Skype, when people sometimes forget to switch their mics on to mute. And also I think we get a clearer stream on the web radio. So I'm just going to take off the message that says we are getting ready to start, so people know that we are live now. You might hear typing noises because I'm actually using the microphone on the laptop, so you'll have to forgive me for that. This session is also being recorded, as we normally do, and we will share this with our listeners after the call. So I think we're all good to go. Let's get started. As always, we must remind ourselves that the reason we have this Dhamma today is because the greatest philosopher that ever lived in the last 2 millennia, Gautama, Lord Buddha, was compassionate enough, was kind enough, was generous enough to share with us what he discovered for himself. After his enlightenment, he was gracious enough to share his message with us, share his understanding which helps beings cross the river of samsara, the ocean of samsara, and unentangle themselves from this web of samsara. So we always are grateful, and as a mark of respect to the Lord Buddha, before we get started, we venerate, reminding ourselves of his great qualities. I'm just going to put the Skype on mute just so we don't get interrupted. That's not to say I can't see your messages. Please feel free to drop any messages you have and or any questions you have, and I can pick them up as well. Okay.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Clearly we are fortunate enough to have received the Lord Buddha's message, his teaching, the Dhamma. But on this occasion, we must also remind ourselves that we have come past many, many beings, friends, family, foe, who in their own way have helped us in one way, in some way, shape or form, to get this far. Whether that be by just pointing us at the right direction when we were lost, or perhaps by offering us a glass of water when we were thirsty. Some of these people we have come past are unfortunately not with us today. Some are in woeful states and are unable to receive the Lord Buddha's Dhamma because of bad karma that they might have committed whilst they were alive. However, when we remind ourselves that it is through the Lord Buddha's compassion, it is because of the Lord Buddha's compassion we have this Dhamma today, it's important that we share at least a modicum of that compassion with everyone else. Not just human beings that we live with today, not just our friends and family, but also beings that we have that are no longer with us. Some of them devas, some of them brahmas, some of them in places that are some of them in unfortunate places, and in our hope, in the hope that they are somehow able to hear this message, receive this message, and in the hope that they may use this Dhamma to understand the reality of life, reality of themselves, reality of the painful nature of this existence, and that understanding helps them come to their senses, really, and helps them cross the ocean of samsara, just as we are now preparing ourselves to do. So as I invite devas, brahmas, and those who we have come past, may I invite you to do the same. Please extend this invitation to your friends and family, to your distant relations, your past relations, to any devas and brahmas who might have helped you along the way, and invite them to come and listen to this Dhamma so that they may share in the joy and in the merits that we are in the process of accumulating today.
Samanta chakvalesu atra gacchantu devata Saddhammam munirajasansa sunantu sagga mokkhadam dhammasavana kalu ayam badanta dhammasavana kalu ayam badanta Dhammasavana kalu ayam badanta.
Okay. As usual, if you have any questions, then please feel free to either drop them on the web radio chat, and we can pick them up from there. Or we also have the Skype DOBBE Dhamma group, which you're welcome to share membership of that group with other friends and family who might benefit from these weekly English discussions. But also, if you have any questions, then please feel free to drop them on there. So, last week, if you remember, we talked about we made a start with trying to get our heads around the causal dependent or the causal origination theory, paticca-samuppada, dependent origination rather. Getting my words mixed up today. Dependent origination. Dependent because it's dependent on causes. Cause and effect is the Lord Buddha's teaching. He doesn't talk about a self. He doesn't talk about a non-self. What he does talk about is causal origination or dependent origination. Making that mistake again. And we discussed how we create these mental pictures in our minds, how vijnana or our consciousness, the magician that is vijnana, creates these mental images using the namarupas, name and form, or upadanita namarupa, name and form that we have accumulated and kind of put aside, put into our stores for use later, and we so strongly cling on to. Using these raw materials, our vijnana creates these mental images, and then that's unfortunately not the end of the story. What happens next is a pity. Vijnana gets us to go do its legwork, the dirty work really. Go find these mental images that only is only a figment of imagination. You know, these images don't really exist anywhere. That's the summary of last week's discussion. We took a number of examples and talked about that. I think it was a good point to enter into this paticca-samuppada discussion. Perhaps we can continue that discussion today, and try and understand what happens beyond that point. So, and I hope that's okay if you have any questions about what we discussed last week, then again, you know, please feel free to drop them online. We can go into a little bit more detail if you perhaps didn't quite understand some of the concepts we discussed last week. But let's try and make a little bit more progress and try and keep a few steps further. So the premise was that these thought objects, or aramunu in Sinhala, thought objects, aramana in Pali, these thought objects enter our minds through the five or the six doors. When the five doors are asleep or they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, or perhaps they're not functioning, then the sixth door, which is the mind itself, will do a fine job of focusing itself on these thought objects. But normally, you have the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, and touch, or your body, which bring these thought objects into your mind. And based on that, you have the what we call the architect, sankhara, or formations, which is the English translation. Now, so one thing that I thought might need a little bit more explanation is the reason we call sankhara, when in fact it's, when we talk about the paticchasamuppada process, and I said there were 24 different types of paticchasamuppada, we're not necessarily going to be talking about all 24 of them, certainly not for some time, because I mentioned this point last week, and it's important for us to remind ourselves about this. You see, if you start delving into Buddhism, if you start diving into the three canons, the Tripitaka, and try to understand potentially everything, or perhaps, you know, you say, imagine you wanted to acquire all the knowledge that the Buddha ever shared with us. Now, unfortunately, that might not be quite possible, because, for starters, it's quite possible that we don't have all of the Dhamma that the Buddha gave us 2,500 years ago. I mean, we have 57 books of the Tripitaka today, but that may not be all of it. There might have been more. But in any case, his teaching, you know, the Buddha's knowledge was universal. There was nothing that he couldn't understand or bring to the grasp of his wisdom if he wanted to. Now, I'll use a metaphor in this example in what I'm trying to express here. Imagine you had a disease. Let's say it was a cancer. A cancer that was a very rare cancer, and imagine there was a treatment for this cancer, but there are perhaps, you know, one or two doctors on the entire planet that had the cure or knew how to treat this cancer. Now this doctor is also a physician. If all you wanted to do, or perhaps the biggest illness, the biggest problem you had, the biggest ailment that you wanted to cure was this cancer, you'll invite the doctor around. You know, it might take a long time for you to get on the waiting list, and then again for this doctor to visit you, and perhaps it's many years after you've made that invitation that he actually gets round to visiting you. But in any case, let's say he turns up, and you know, your main objective is to get this cancer cured. What if you spent time talking about, you know, just a normal headache that you had, or perhaps, you know, you're curious about other aspects of medicine, and this doctor is not going to be around for much long, for very long, because he's got to go treat other patients, or perhaps, you know, he's a human being himself, so what guarantee do you have that he's going to be around for very long, when, you know, you and I can't guarantee our own lives? But, you know, you've got to use what you've got, the tools you've got, to the best you can. There's no point using a screwdriver to nail something down, you know, to hammer a nail down. You'd use a hammer for that. A screwdriver, when you get hold of a screwdriver, use a screwdriver for that purpose. Likewise, when you have the Buddha's Dhamma, remember that we are all stuck in this web of samsara, like I said at the beginning. Now, shouldn't that be our main concern? Do we, just because the Lord Buddha talks about the infinite universe and his wisdom, his knowledge knew no bounds, and would, you know, he knew everything there was to know, and in many places in the Tripitaka itself, he might have described or attempted to describe everything that he, you know, universal truths and things about the universe, things about animals' origins, where we've come from, etc., etc. Do we spend time trying to understand these things? Or perhaps, you know, in the short time that we have his Dhamma, do we use that opportunity to treat the biggest problem, the most serious problem that we have, which is being stuck in samsara? And Paticchasamuppada is, I think, a fine example of that. Because as I said last week, using Paticchasamuppada, you can describe the origination of absolutely everything. Absolutely anything and everything that has been created due to causes, dependent on causes, the creation of which is dependent on causes, can be explained through Paticchasamuppada. But we've got to understand that the problem we are trying to treat is our journey in samsara. So let's use that for that, and let's make sure we've got our heads around how Paticchasamuppada helps us stop this rebirth process, how understanding of that helps us stop this rebirth process, before we go into the detail of, well, can you explain how Paticchasamuppada gives rise to this universe, for example. Let's not worry about that for now, is what I'm trying to say. So, we were talking about Abhisankara and Sankara. When someone's intention is to create something, and clearly when you have a thought object come into your mind, you know, that could be a bit of a piece of music, it could be the sight of a food item, or it could be, you know, perhaps a toy, I don't know, it could be absolutely anything. Your architect, which is Sankara, tries to it goes into hyperdrive mode. And what it does, it invites Vijnana to go pick up all of these raw materials from Nama Rupa, name and form. You know, bring me everything you've got on this subject. And then Vijnana goes away, bringing back all of these Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana. And uses these to create this picture, and now your mind is busy getting your innocent five senses, your eyes, your nose, your tongue, your mouth, your tongue, your body, running errands and trying to find in the world what you've created as a mental picture. It's just started thundering, and I hope that doesn't interrupt your interrupt this session. We'll continue. Let's see if it causes a problem. Unfortunately, I don't have a microphone as such. I'm just using the one on the laptop. Let's hope things work out. Let's hope there are the right causes to give us the effect which is for all of us to make the best and the most out of today's session. So that is the creation of Vijnana. Vijnana then uses Nama Rupa Paccaya Salayatana, which is, you know, getting your senses to go into hyperdrive mode. Salayatana Paccaya Passa is contact. So now your senses go looking for in the world. It goes flying, it goes swimming in this world, trying to find this mental image that has just been created and has been ordered of it. And now it goes looking for it. Well, the shame is it's not going to find it. But that doesn't stop it from trying to find it. You know, this is the delusion. This is exactly the problem. It's this delusion that we think, you know, tomorrow I'm going to find this, or the day after I'm going to find this, next year I'm going to find this. When we fail to realize, how long have you been alive? Haven't you been looking for that? You know, this joy, happiness. Have you not been looking for that your entire life? Even if you're 40 years of age, have you not been looking for it for 40 years? What makes you think you're going to find it tomorrow? What makes you think you're going to find it today? What about your parents, your grandparents? You know, how old are they? You know, they might not be alive today. Did they not spend their entire lifetime trying to find what you're thinking you're going to find tomorrow? Many, many generations. Many, many generations have tried to find it ever since humans began this journey of, you know, intelligence and evolving. you know, they've tried to find this and yet they haven't, and we still think we're going to find it. So this is the delusion that we're in. But in any case, your senses come back and report, here's what I've found. And then your mind now makes an evaluation. And the evaluation is, I asked you to bring me something. Your senses come back and say, well, this is what we found. The mind now does the evaluation. Is this what I asked for? If it is what it has asked for, it's going to be happy. If it isn't what it asks for, it's going to be sad, naturally. Now, remember, we're saying that when the mind goes out looking for what, you know, when your five senses go away looking for what, for this mental picture that has been created, it's never going to find it because that doesn't exist and it's just a figment of your imagination. And now I'm saying, well, what if it does find it? Are you not going to be happy? And you might think, well, hang on, there's a contradiction there. Well, actually, there isn't. Let me explain. So, let's take an example. Let's say, let us say that we have, there's a girl that I'm interested in. Okay, so I'm still a lay person, and I'm going to see this girl. I'm seeing her for the first time, and as I see her face, I'm thinking, oh, she's pretty. And now I'm thinking, she's probably got beautiful teeth. Okay, so how am I thinking all of these when I haven't even seen her, her open her mouth yet? I haven't seen her teeth yet. Well, I'm thinking all of these because, remember, that's my architect. That's my Abhisankara. That's my Abhisankara instructing my Vijnana to go into my Namarupa, my Upadhanita Namarupa, the Namarupa that I'm clinging on to so hard, so strongly, so forcefully, so fiercely. Okay? And in my Namarupa, there are Rupas which say that, you know, if a girl's pretty, then she's got to have beautiful teeth. Beautiful white teeth. That's what my Vijnana is telling me. That could be different for somebody else. Perhaps it's, I don't know, someone might like tainted teeth. I don't know. But, you know, it's horses for courses, right? But let's say that's what my Vijnana has just created for itself. And now it's looking for this. Now it's hoping. In fact, it's now even set this expectation. I'm going to see this girl open her mouth and she's going to have beautiful white teeth. So that's my expectation now. Now, remember I've said before, expectation is what is the route to disappointment. It's the gateway to disappointment. Well, let's see how that happens. So you've now set this expectation. The girl begins to smile. You know, you're cracking a joke, hoping you get to see her smile. So you've just cracked this joke, and now she's beginning to part her lips. And you're expecting 32 beautiful white teeth in her mouth. She's just started to, part her lips, and you're seeing the first two teeth in the front of her mouth. And you're seeing that actually one of them is crystal white. Perfect. That's what you wanted. But the other, has a yellow shade. It's not quite what you wanted. You know, it's not quite the white that you wanted. It's gonna be yellow. She hasn't been to the dentist recently. Oh well. Now, imagine, well, actually, let's try and understand what the mind does at this point. At that very moment, your eye is reporting, Mr. Mind, here's what I'm seeing. Yes, you asked me to go find 32 beautiful white teeth. But what I'm seeing right now is one white tooth and one yellow tooth. And that report comes back to your mind. What do you think your mind does now? Your mind goes into disappointment mode for a fraction of a second. Sometimes you don't even feel it. But now you understand this happens. Observe how your mind works the next time round. Now, it doesn't have to be when you see a girl. You know, it could be when you've been invited to lunch. At your friend's place, and you're already thinking of all the nice foods you've had at their place before, and you're thinking, I'm going to have that again today. Or perhaps you've decided to go to a restaurant and someone asks you, hey, shall we go out to a restaurant tonight? And you're thinking, I'd love a bit of Chinese. You go out in the evening and your friend's stopping at an Indian restaurant. That's not quite what I wanted, but I'm here now. But at that very moment, your mind goes into disappointment mode. Why? Because it did set an expectation. The expectation was, in the example of the girl, 32, all 32, beautiful white teeth. And now your eyes are reporting back, one white tooth, one yellow tooth. It goes into disappointment mode for a fraction of a second. Do you know what it does next? It's now telling itself, the mind runs another Paticca-samuppada process, and it says, that's okay, I'm happy with 31 beautiful white teeth. And now what do you think it's looking for? 31 beautiful white teeth. So forget the 32, because it knows, okay, this is the reality, one of them has gone yellow, one of them has been tainted, let's go for 31. So the girl now parts her lips ever so slightly again. So imagine how fast these cycles must be running. We're talking about a billionth of a second. A billionth of a second. Because it doesn't take, it doesn't take a second. It doesn't take more than a second for someone to part their lips and for them to smile. So imagine how fast these things are happening. Your mind is running at this point in time. It's going into overdrive mode. So it's now seeing one white tooth, one yellow tainted tooth, but the girl's parting her lips again. And now what you're seeing is actually one of her teeth has fallen. That's not what you asked for. So, but your eyes are now reporting, okay, there's one beautiful white tooth, there's one yellow tainted tooth, and but the next tooth has actually fallen. So that is now the report that's coming back into your mind. And guess what your mind does now? It resets its expectation. What is the expectation now? Well, at first it goes into disappointment because it wanted 31 beautiful white teeth. It was fine with one yellow tooth, but it wasn't fine with one tooth that had fallen, because that was not the expectation. So it's got to reset its expectation now. So the reset expectation is one yellow tainted tooth, one fallen tooth, and guess what? 30. Beautiful white teeth. So this is the reality of how the mind works. And this is why I said at the beginning, these mental images that we create, we're never going to find out there because it doesn't exist. Remember, these pictures it brings from, this picture of a girl smiling and the 32 beautiful white teeth, where do you think it's getting it from? TV adverts. Adverts in magazines, or sometimes perhaps a friend saying, hey, I've been to this dentist and, I saw this picture, or, have you seen this movie lately? And, this girl, she had beautiful white teeth. So it's pulling all of these bits of information that it's gained from listening to people talk. It's got from TV adverts, sometimes even radio adverts. Yeah, you can't see teeth on a radio advert, but the radio advert says, hey, you use this new toothpaste and you're going to have beautiful white teeth. And as soon as that is said, your mind's going into, oh yeah, that's what I like. And it takes that picture, it creates the imagery for it and puts it in the Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vijnana storeroom, for use later. But you see how it's always disappointment after disappointment. So when we say actually that the mind is able to observe what it asked for, That's only because that expectation has been reset every single time. But every single time, first it goes into disappointment, and then expectation reset, and now it gets the, okay, I'm okay, I'll settle with that. It's always, I'll settle for that. It's not a, this is what I want, so I'm happy with what I've got, because it never finds it. I hope that bit is clear. If not, let me know. In any case, once the expectation has been reset, and now the reset expectation is what is being met, clearly, you get the passapaccaya vedana. Vedana is feeling, or Vedana in this context can be, you know, how something is perceived. So that Vedana, that feeling can be threefold. You get Sukha Vedana, you get Dukkha Vedana, and you get Adukkama Sukha Vedana. What is that? So that's in Pali. What's in English? Dukkha Vedana is, I suppose we could say that's a sad feeling or disappointment. Sukha Vedana is happy feeling or satisfaction. And then Adukkama Sukha is a neutral feeling. So if it got what it asked for, then remember that is again the reset expectation, not what it asked for in the first place. Actually, here's another example. You walk up to McDonald's, you ask for a double cheeseburger. Guess what they say? I'm sorry, sir, we've run out. What happens at that moment in time? Do you not feel disappointed? Of course you do. And then what do you say? Well, actually, can I have a single cheeseburger then? Forget the double. I just have a single. And then they go, sorry, sir, we run out of single cheeseburgers as well. Oh, for heaven's sake, can I just have maybe a bag of crisps then? Yeah, we've got that. Ah, now the mind isn't waiting anymore for a double cheeseburger or a single cheeseburger. It's actually waiting for a bag of crisps, or a bag of chips even. The chips arrive, and guess what? You're happy. Well, clearly, because the expectation has been reset. That is the only way the mind can be made happy, unless you're looking for happiness outside of this material world and this material existence, which is where we try to take this conversation. But in any case, we're talking about avidya paccaya paticchasamuppada, you know, paticchasamuppada, which is based in delusion, in ignorance, and there is no place for nibbana in paticchasamuppada that is based in ignorance or delusion. So, Sukha Vedana, Dukkha Vedana, the problematic Vedana here is particularly Sukha Vedana, because the moment you receive Sukha Vedana, or happy feeling, what happens next is again digging a hole for yourself. It really is that. The mind forgets that actually this happy feeling I've only received because my expectation was reset, and now, you know, I'm getting what I asked for the second time, but not the first time. It's now I'm getting for the second time. But it's thinking, this made me happy. You know, whatever I'm interacting with, the sights that I'm seeing, the sounds that I'm hearing, the taste that I'm sensing and the feeling that I'm receiving, that's making me happy because that's what I asked for. Well, the second time, yeah. This is what I asked for. And what it does next is just mind-boggling. Vedana paccaya tanha. So the mind now attaches itself to this feeling. And not just the feeling, but all of the aggregates, the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana, that actually brought along this feeling. So if it was a food, then all of the rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vijnana about that food. So again, let's remind ourselves, rupa is form, Vedana is feeling, sanya is perception or identification, sankara is formation, and vijnana is thoughts. If I were to give you an example, you know, going back to McDonald's, your double cheeseburger, your rupa is, you know, again, this is when we talk about rupa, there's chakku rupa, sota rupa, gana rupa, juha rupa, kaya rupa, mano rupa. So that's rupa that is to do with your eyes. So that is basically, you know, what you're seeing when we talk about a cheeseburger. The buns, the sesame seeds, the salad leaves, the tomato, and the burger itself. Maybe perhaps the ketchup. So, you know, these are all sights you're seeing. What about the sounds? Maybe it's the music that they play at McDonald's. Perhaps it's the, you know, it's the chit chat that you have with your friends on your way to McDonald's, or you know how the clerk at the till rings you up and you know rings up the bill, or perhaps you know if it's a drive through, you know, it's all of that. It's all the sounds that you've associated with having a cheeseburger at McDonald's. So that's chakku vedana, sota vedana. Then you have chakku rupa and sota rupa even. Then there's gana rupa. Gana is nose, and Gana, so then you have the nose, so it's smell we are talking about here. So it's all the smells to do with the burger. You know, it's basically the smells that are associated with the burger. And that might not necessarily be just the smell of the burger, but it could be all the smells of the restaurant itself. Perhaps the perfume that they use, maybe the air freshener that they use. You know, all of these things, good heavens, you know, your mind is attached to. Because the moment someone asks, would you like to have a double cheeseburger at McDonald's? Even the smell of the air freshener at McDonald's, perhaps you were attached to that. Why? Because, you know, that gave you good feeling. Because otherwise, why do you think restaurants spend so much money on how the place looks and feels? All of the sensory touches that they include, you know, the music that they play, the smells the perfume that they use, sorry, the air freshener that they use, you know, sometimes the scented towels that they use. You don't need a scented towel to wipe your hands or your lips. You just need a towel, a wet towel. Why does it have to be scented? You know, but this is all to do with these rupas that it gives you. You know, that is all created to entangle you in the sensory minefield that is to attach you and bind you to this existence. Unfortunately, we fall for it. Our vijnana falls for it. You know, remember, it's not the world's fault. It's not anybody else's fault. Remember again, there are two types of people. What are they? One points at the mirror, the other points at the window and says, the fault is with you. Which one are you? Do you point at the window or do you point at the mirror? The answer is yours. So it's all of these, you know, rupa, chakurupa, gandharupa. Then you have the gandharupa, rasarupa. Obviously, the taste of the burger. You know, why do you start salivating the moment you ask for a cheeseburger at the restaurant, or even when someone asks you? You haven't even left home yet, or even got off your sofa. Someone has only asked you, would you like a double cheeseburger from McDonald's? And McDonald's is like 3 miles away from home. And you are still on the sofa in your pajamas. And you're salivating. Why? Because, you know, your vinyan has already brought back all of these rupas that it had put away in the storeroom, because it's now building this picture, this mental picture, and getting your senses to go into hyperdrive mode. You know, go find it. Say yes. Say you want it. Go get it. So those are all the rupas. Then obviously you have the vedana. You know, all of the feeling that you got. You know, the sounds, the actual feeling of how things went. It could be how the customer service person at the till or the clerk at the restaurant made you feel. You know, all of that is got to do with vedana. This is why they train. They, you know, restaurants invest so much in training their staff up, because they have to make you feel good. What's that got to do with the double cheeseburger? If you've paid for your cheeseburger, you get your cheeseburger, you have your cheeseburger. What's it got to do with how the person, you know, the clerk, how they interact with you, how they talk to you, whether they make you happy? Because that's all, you know, your vijnana is looking for all of that. That's the reason. It's got nothing to do with how the burger tastes. It's only because your vijnana is looking for it. You know, those vedana, those feelings. And all of that is, it associates with a good cheeseburger. So when someone asks, what does a good cheeseburger look like? What does a good cheeseburger feel like? Guess what you're thinking? You're not only thinking about the sesame seeds. You're not only thinking about the burger or the bun that's on it, how soft the bun is. Sorry if I'm making you salivate here. But, you know, if I am, then again, you know, guess who's doing that? It's not me. It's your vijnana that's doing it. But the point is, you know, when someone says, you know, how does a good cheeseburger feel like, you're also thinking about good customer service. You're thinking about how, you know, how clean the restaurant is. How polite the staff is at the restaurant. All of these things, even without your knowledge, sometimes in your subconsciousness, you know, all of these things come to the surface, and you're looking for all of these, and your vijnana is creating this mental image. Okay, so in any case, you've got this, you're now attaching yourself to this. So vedana paccaya tanha, Tanha paccha then upadana. Upadana as in closely associating or very closely associating. So what it does at that point is, if, remember, you've now got this good sensation, this good feeling, because again, I keep reiterating this point, it's because your expectations have been reset. It's not because it's what you asked for the first time. Remember, you never find that. You will never find what you asked for the first time. It's always, you should reset your expectation because this is what you've got to settle for. And it's always a case of, I'm settling for less. That is what we do when we live in this world. You never find what you're looking for. You just settle for what there is. That is the reality. You settle for what there is. You never find what you're looking for. Food for thought, eh? Vedana pacha tanha, tanha pacha upadana. So what are you going to do with all of these rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, vinyana that you're getting now? If you've had a good experience, a good sensation, you're going to put them away in your storeroom. You're going to add this rupa, add this vedana, add this sankara, add this vinyana to your storeroom. And remember, again, with sankara, I was describing, you know, I was giving examples of the rupa, the vedana, the sanya, you know, sanya being the identification. It's about identifying all of the things that are there. Perhaps, you know, they have a mascot in front of McDonald's. You identify that. You relate to that. And, you know, again, that goes into your storeroom as well. What about the sankara? What about the friends you went there with? You know, even things like that makes a difference. If you go to a restaurant and you didn't have a good time, nothing to do with the food, nothing to do with the service, nothing to do with how the restaurant looked or felt, but to do with how you felt with the person that you went there with. You know, perhaps you thought it was your boyfriend or your girlfriend, and you went there and they let you down, they broke up with you in the restaurant. Chances are you're never going to go back into that restaurant. Why is that? Because now the sankara that you built while you were there and the sankara that you associate with that restaurant are not good ones. Not ones that gave you sukha vedana. They are ones that gave you dukkha vedana. Dukkha vedana doesn't lead to attachment. That leads to patiga or conflict. So that's how that works. But the things that gave you all the good feelings, the good vedana, the sukha vedana, the happy feelings, all of that goes into your upadana skanda, so you can use it another time. To do what? To create that mental image again. See how we dig a hole for ourselves every single time? It's just crazy, is it not? And then, vedana paccaya tanha, tanha paccaya upadana, upadana paccaya bhava. What's this bhava here? Bhava being existence. Now, normally when we talk about paticchasamuppada, people often only talk about bhava in the next birth. And they're talking about an existence, you know, it's talking about the next birth. You know, next birth being, it could be a human birth, it could be a birth as a deva or a brahma, or perhaps in a hell. Hopefully not, but you know, that does happen. But what we're talking about bhava here, existence in this context, is the fact that we've just created, or you know, this process that is paticchasamuppada has, you know, it's a process, and a process gives an output. Whatever that process is, you get an output from that process. There's an input, there's something that happens in the middle, and then there's an output. What was the input? The thought object was the input. The arammana in Pali, aramana in Sinhala, and thought object in English was the input. The input went through the avidya paccaya, sankara, sankara paccaya, vinyana, vinyana paccaya, namarupa, namarupa paccaya, salayatana, salayatana paccaya, passa, passa paccaya, vedana, vedana paccaya, tanha, tanha paccaya, bhava. Bhava is one of the outputs. So bhava is in fact the existence. So it's about existence at that moment. In the context of, or in the example of the, you know, the person walking up to McDonald's wanting a cheeseburger, it's creating that existence. It's creating the being at that moment in time that is wanting a cheeseburger or is mentally, you know, interested or is mentally rejoicing, is mentally craving a cheeseburger. And then you have the Vavapachya Jati. Jati is the birth. Again, we often take on these occasions for birth to be birth in the next. You know, we talk about rebirth, and in fact, there's a question about rebirth which we'll come to in a bit. But But this is, in this context, birth is not necessarily about rebirth. You know, obviously and clearly, in the process of rebirth, Paticchasamuppada comes into play. But here we're talking about birth in that moment. So it could be, let's say you're feeling angry. It's the birth of someone that is feeling angry at that moment in time. Let's say you're feeling happy. It's, you know, it's the Paticchasamuppada process that gives birth to the person, to a being that is happy at that moment in time. The next moment, you know, you could be sad, you could be feeling compassionate, you could be feeling angry, you could be feeling disappointed or in love. You know, all of these things are, all of these feelings, all of these types of existence are an output of the Paticchasamuppada process. Okay, so then you have Bhavapachya Jati. And then Jatipachya Jara Marana Shoka Parideva Dukkha Domanasa Upayasa Sambhavanti. Unfortunately, all Paticchasamuppada processes that begin with avidya end up here. That is the problem. Jatipachya Jara. Jara is decay. Marana. Marana is death. Shoka. Shoka is to be sorrowful. Parideva. Parideva is to lament. Dukkha is to be sad. Domanasa is to be in a state of aversion. When you're looking for consolence. Shoka Parideva Dukkha Domanasa Upayasa. Upayasa is that feeling of, you know, I'm exhausted. That's exactly what it is. Exhaustion. Okay? Shoka Parideva Dukkha Domanasa Upayasa Sambhavanti. Sambhavanti, what does that mean? Sang Bhavanti. Bhavanti, you've just given rise to. Bhavanti, you've just given rise to. And sang being, you know, avidya tanha, delusion and attachment. So that's what happened, and that is the problem. That's the symptom of the problem. It's not the cause for the problem, but the symptom of the problem. You've just created this process of which, or you've gone through this process, which has given the output, which is bhava and jati, and unfortunately, jati is anicca. What do I mean by that? All types of jati, all types of birth, whether that's rebirth in another plane as a human, as a deva or a brahma, or whether that's birth birth at that moment in time, birth as a compassionate person, birth as a kind person, or birth as someone that's craving some food, all of that is subject to decay, to death, to sorrow, to lamentation. Why? Because it's all based on expectations, remember? You've set expectations, you're now... it's all based on causes and condition, cause and effect. So when the causes changes, the effect changes, hetupala. When the effect changes, but you've had expectation that, you know, this is what I want, this is what I'm enjoying, well, unfortunately, that goes to death and decay, and then you start suffering. But as long as we have this condition that is avidya or delusion, what do? We start this process again and again and again. Now, I'll give you a metaphor that will hopefully explain this. This thing that we do with avidya, with delusion. Imagine you had a rash on your arm. Now, this rash, as long as you, let's say, you know, as long as you leave the rash as it is, it disappears after a while. The body can treat itself with most conditions. You know, the body can treat itself. Okay, or perhaps you might apply some medicine. But what happens is because this rash is itchy, you start scratching yourself. Well, when you scratch yourself, it feels good. It feels good because, you know, you're feeling the urge to itch. You can't resist it, and you go for it. So you then start scratching away, and before you know it, you know, you've made your rash worse. It's now bleeding, or it's, you know, it's become a wound now. It was just a rash before, and now it's a wound. So let's relate this to this avidya and this paticca-samuppada process and how it relates to avidya and tanha. Avidya is this rash in this metaphor. So delusion is your rash, okay? Which means it's a problem. You've got to treat it. You've got to get rid of it, because obviously you've got a disease. You've got a condition. You've got to treat it. But tanha is this urge to which it's this itch that you won't, it's that urge you can't resist. That's tanha. As long as tanha exists, as long as you feel the urge to itch and you go for it. Now, if you don't go for it, if you resist it, even if it feels itchy, but you resist the urge, you know that over time your rash is going to go away, because you're not going to make it worse. You keep treating it. You apply some medicine, and maybe a cream or some ointment, and you treat it. But if you start scratching it, and if you can't resist the urge to itch, then what happens? It gets worse. Every time you do it, it gets worse. The relationship between avidya and tanha is very much the same. As long as avidya or delusion exists, you have tanha, which is attachment. But if you then go and attach yourself, if you can't resist this temptation to attach yourself to things without understanding the reality of how things make you unhappy, how it's attachment itself that makes you sad and disappointed and full of sorrow, if you don't realize that, and you go for it, and you start scratching yourself, what happens next? You suffer. You start hurting. You go into pain. And I hope that explains the difference between avidya and tanha, delusion and attachment, and how as long as avidya exists, clearly you have attachment. As long as avidya exists, as long as delusion exists, or ignorance exists, you have attachment. But if you don't, if when you feel the urge to itch, you fight that temptation, you fight that temptation to do that, then you're gonna, that rash is gonna go away. All you've got to do is treat it, and you treat it with medicine. What's the medicine in this context? It's the Buddha's Dhamma, anicca dukkha anatta. Okay, so hopefully that explains that. I'm just going to have a quick look at questions that have come through. So I will pick up the one that came in last, because it's related to what we're talking about here. What happens if you do achieve your expectation? Example, you pass an exam you expected to pass. Okay, so you pass an exam you expected to pass. Let's see the paticca-samuppada process there. Let's see the paticca-samuppada process there. So you have this, again, that starts with avidya, because anytime you set an expectation, that is avidya. Okay, so your avidya or your delusion is saying, I'm going to do this exam and I'm going to pass it. That is what I want to happen, and therefore that's what's going to happen. Well, in fact, so you're setting this expectation. So there's a bit of thundering in the background, and hopefully that's not distracting you too much. I'm gonna continue, hoping that you can still hear what I'm saying. If you can't, then please let me know. So you said this. We start with avidya paccaya sankhara. So sankhara is going, is in hyperdrive mode. It's creating these mental formations, and it's now getting vijnana to create these mental images of you having passed the exam. So imagine you've sat your exam, you're going to pass the exam, you're now waiting for your results to come, okay? But your vijnana is creating this mental image of you passing the exam, of what you're going to do after you pass your exam, of you know how you you're going to get this job that you wanted, or perhaps you're going to go to the next, you're going to get promoted, you know, whatever that what you're expecting is, and then you have the nam, you know, so you're using the namarupa to do this. So vijnana paccha namarupa, namarupa paccha salayatana, and now the, you know, the, so your senses are now waiting for this information. So in this case, it's your mind, your mano manendriya is waiting for this information. Paccha salayatana, salayatana paccha passa. So now you get the result announced. So perhaps you check your results and it says you've passed. So what happens on that occasion? Well, listen to it. So on this occasion, you have set your expectation, which is to pass, and you then do pass the exam. What happens then? So in this occasion, what if you knew that you were going to pass the exam, what do you think happened on that occasion? If you knew you were going to pass the exam without a shadow of a doubt, so let's say, I'll give an example, right? Let's take it's going to be a silly example, but let's go with it. Say you are of the age 20, okay? So you're well past your you know, you've done all your exams, you've completed your you know, most of your education. Now this exam is asking you to at the exam you're just asked to do some basic math, some addition, maybe some subtraction. Say, let's say, you know, all it's asking you to do is add two numbers up. What is 10 plus 10? Or what is 10 plus 20? That is the exam. I know I said it was going to be a silly example, but let's go with the flow. Now, if you've sat that exam, what are you now expecting as your result? You're expecting to pass the exam. Why are you now expecting to pass the exam? It's because you're looking at the causes and you're looking at the effect. The causes to pass this exam are that you would have had to go sit the exam, because if you didn't sit the exam, no matter how easy the question paper was, you're not going to pass it. You've gone and sat the exam. You've completed the exam in the time that you were allotted. You went through the paper. You answered all of the questions. So there were two questions. One was, what is 10 plus 10? The other was, add 10 to the last answer, and you know very clearly, you know crystal clear, there's no, without a shadow of a doubt, you've passed it, you've answered the question correctly, and now you've surrendered your paper, you know, which is all, everything you need to do to pass that exam. So now you're expecting this result to come. What you're seeing here is cause and effect, clearly cause and effect, because you know all of the courses that need to line up, and you're seeing for yourself that all of the courses for that effect have been fulfilled. There isn't any cause that has not been fulfilled for the effect to take place. There isn't any cause that has not been fulfilled for this effect to take place. Now, on this occasion, what happens there is actually you get this feeling of equanimity, or this feeling of upeksha. Why? Because you're seeing cause and effect take place. If the expectation was one that was founded in causes that you were not able to view, not able to grasp, then clearly when the result comes out, you know, you're going to be delighted. But on this occasion, if you know you're going to pass that exam, then at the moment that you get the result, so cast your memory back to a time when this might have happened. You know you're going to pass that exam. There isn't a shadow of a doubt you're going to pass that exam. The result comes, and the moment you get the result, you look at the result and go, yeah, that's what I expected. You're not feeling over the moon. Obviously, you're not feeling disappointed. What you're feeling is upeksha or equanimity. However,
There is a moment where you do feel over the moon, but that is afterwards. How so? Because you now pass the exam, but you don't stop there. Your thoughts are now, your thoughts have already built up all of these things that you want to do after you pass the exam, such as go get this job, go, you know, get a promotion, get a higher pay, or perhaps, you know, go to the next class. So all of these expectations that you've built up, you know, these were not lined up in cause and effect. You didn't fully think through the causes for this. Well, clearly your exam result is one cause, but you know there are plenty others that need to line up before you can see the next step. But if it's just the exam that you're thinking about, and the result that came after you sat the exam because you were absolutely clear what the result was going to be for that exam, all you're saying is here are the causes, and I knew what the causes were. I'm now getting the result. Why do I need to be elated about this? That at that moment in time when you get the result, that's a feeling of equanimity. But this feeling of overjoy, this feeling of elatedness, and this feeling of this happiness is all to do with expectations that you build the moment after you get that result. It's, you know, what am I going to do now? You know, I've got this result. I'm now going to go tell other people about it. I'm going to, you know, be really happy about myself. I'm going to cast my memory back to all the work that I did to pass this exam. So what you're doing there is you're building up all of these mental images again, and now you're relating this result to be you're relating all of these results that you got from the exam to all of those mental images that you built up. And therefore, that feeling of joy that you're getting is to do with setting that expectation and that expectation having been met. So hopefully that explains the question there. That answers the question. If it's not clear, then you know please do prompt me again. If the answer to that is not clear. There was another question about taking medication to cure an illness. What is the view as a Buddhist? Well, I can't really see anything wrong with taking medication to cure an illness. In fact, the Lord Buddha allowed Siupase for the Sangha. So the Siupase being four and Pase being what we are allowed to take as monks. So you have food for hunger, which is again, I mean, let's be honest, taking food for hunger is a medication for illness, is it not? Then the Buddha allowed us to take, so clearly there's nothing wrong with that. Then there's shelter from the elements, and there's nothing wrong with having shelter. You know, that's a roof over your head, it's four walls around you, there's nothing wrong with that. A bed to lie down. Then there's clothing, which is also part of that, to again protect yourself from the elements. So that's chivara. In Sinhala that's so, and in English that's robes. So food, robes, shelter, and medicine. And in Sinhala in Pali even we call it chivara for robes. Pindapata for food, Senasana for shelter and clothing, and Dilampasa for medication. So all these four things that the Buddha prescribed for even to the Sangha. So clearly there's nothing wrong with you taking any of these as long as you take it to achieve the right purpose. You know, that's the case with anything really. Well, most things. What's wrong is wrong, but When you use, you know, whether it's food, medicine, shelter or clothing, you better always use it for what it's intended. If you're eating food to satisfy your hunger, there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're eating food to satisfy your taste buds, to satisfy your tongue, then clearly you're giving, you know, that's rooted in raga dvesha raga or dvesha or moha, the Muslim raga. And if you're taking even medicines, if you're taking medicines, say for instance, some people take medicine for bodybuilding. Now, I'm not here to say whether that's right or wrong, but what I'm saying is, if your intention is to build your body up and you're taking medicines for that, then that's not necessarily in line with the principles that the Buddha taught, which is, existence is suffering in the first place. Why prolong your existence for the sake of it, when actually we should be using our existence, our lives, to understand the Four Noble Truths and to try and put an end to this suffering. Now, as we're talking about food and medicines, I'll give you a couple of things that I've been doing recently when I'm taking food. So the other day I was thinking, sometimes when food is served, when we go for alms into the bowl, the patre, I've seen sometimes, people turn the bowl around after they've sat down, as in the monk might sit down and turn the bowl around so that, your rice is in one place, is in the right place even, your curries are it's all laid out in the right places. Oftentimes you do it at home as well. If, say, someone serves you a plate of food, say your mother has just served you a plate of food, or perhaps your partner, and they will bring you this plate, you are now sat down in front of the TV, on the sofa, and they hand you this plate. The first thing you might do is actually turn this plate around so that usually the staple food, which is normally, say it's rice or maybe spaghetti, or whatever the case might be, is kind of right in front of you, and then you have the curries or perhaps the condiments around you, or around the main dish. What I was thinking to myself is, why is it I do it that way? Because once I eat this food, once I swallow this food, it goes down my esophagus, down into my stomach, and in my stomach, my stomach doesn't treat rice as a separate dish, or the curries that I eat. Imagine I'm eating dal curry, or perhaps bean curry. Maybe I'm having papadums or something like that. Yeah, it's not going to treat each of those items as separate food items. It's not going to treat ice cream as ice cream. It's not going to treat fruit as fruit. Everything is the same to my tummy. So in my stomach, it's all one big pudding. So why do I bother then to turn my bowl around, as a layperson? Why would I bother turning my plate around just so that I need to arrange my food in a certain way, just for the duration that it goes past my mouth and down my tongue? Actually, not even past my mouth, down my tongue. It's actually just for the time it goes from my bowl or from my plate in my hand. Actually, even forget that, because by the time I'm putting my food in my mouth, it's all mixed up. If you eat by hand, then you're going to mix all your food up together. So it really makes no difference which order you eat your food in. Really think about this. Imagine I ask you to work in an office, right? So I'm the manager. I've hired you to go spend some time in an office. And I want you to give me a report at the end of a week. Because the reason I've hired you is because I'm thinking, there's things we could do in the office to improve the efficiency of the workers. Now, you go into the office on a Monday, and you start observing how things happen in this office. So you're seeing that there's one person who receives in their inbox a bunch of papers, and what this person does is they pick up these papers and they shuffle them in a certain order. The order is only obvious to the person that's doing it, and then they staple this, or perhaps uses a paper clip, and what they do is they pass it along to somebody else who's in another room. And then this person, the first thing they do is actually remove the staple, rearranges the sheets of paper, staples the sheets of paper again, and then passes it along. Now, if I was the person that was observing this process, what do you think is the first thing I'm going to ask myself, and then possibly ask the people that are doing it? Well, the question is, why does the first person staple all these papers in a particular order, when actually the next person down the line, the first thing they do is unstaple these sheets of paper, reshuffles them, and then staples them again? What's the whole point of doing that? As far as I'm concerned, the first person is superfluous. They're not really adding any value to the process. So I might report back to the manager to say, you know, there isn't really a point in what the first person is trying to do here. Now, if you think back to how you take your food, are we not doing something very similar? Whereby you sit down to eat, you now go to your rice, you've got your curries around around the main food. What you do now is actually you rotate your plate, you turn your bowl or your plate around, so that you have your rice in front of you, your curries around you, your condiments around you, and so on and so forth. What's the point of doing that? Because that's like the first person in the office, because they're now arranging, and sometimes actually, if you have curries in the wrong place on your dish, what do you normally do? You pick it up and you move it outside, you move it out of the way. You move it out of the way so that it's not obstructing your view of the plate, your view of the food on your plate. I hope you can still hear me. It's raining really heavily. Raining cats and dogs. And there's thundering in the background, but I hope you can still hear me. I've moved the microphone as close to my mouth as I possibly can. So I can't really see much of what you're typing, but hopefully you can hear what I'm saying. And I'm trying to speak as loudly as I can. So, we were talking about the plate. So, isn't what we're doing, which is, you know, pushing these curries out of the way and kind of arranging it in a certain way on my plate, very similar to what the first person is doing in the office? Because as soon as you've arranged it in that order, you then mix it all up. You either by using utensils, you know, maybe a spoon or a fork, or perhaps with your fingers. Or, you know, even if you didn't do all of that, you put it in your mouth. What do you do is the moment you put it in your mouth, you start chewing your food. Good luck trying to separate it all out once it comes out of your mouth. If you were to spit it all out, do you think you'd ever be able to now separate all of these items of food up? You know, say you were eating rice and you know, several types of curry. Do you think there would be any chance ever of separating one of those bits out of it? And then again, you know, it goes down your throat, down your esophagus, into your stomach. What do you think happens there? It's what the second person does. Reshuffles it all. So, thinking about it then, the only reason that we rearrange our dish, our plate, and our bowl as a monk is because, well, you don't like the sight of it. Is that not the only reason? You just don't like the sight of it. You want your food to be arranged in a certain order so that you can see your rice in the middle, you know, and your curries in, you know, surrounding it, your condiments surrounding it. Isn't that just a view that we hold, or what we call a drishtiya, or a dikti in Pali? Isn't that just a view that we hold, that this is how my plate should be? When actually, pragmatically, it doesn't add any value whatsoever. Now, I know and I fully understand that in lay life, you know, there are certain things that we have to do, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense, because, you know, people look at us, and we've got to live by rules that society has set for us. And so if you're thinking you're free living in society as a lay person, well, think again. Sorry to say that, but you know, we've got to live our life by rules and standards that society set for us. So society expects us to have our rice in the middle and the curries around it, the condiments around it. If you were to eat like I do, when people serve food into my bowl, when I go on alms, so sometimes, you know, there's yogurt on dal. Sometimes there's rice on ice cream. Sometimes there's a piece of meat or fish on some other dish. Maybe there's some panivalalu on some yogurt. To me, it really doesn't matter, because all I'm thinking is, well, why do I bother when actually the moment it goes into my mouth, well, it's all jumbled up again. It's all a mixture again. It's all, you know, it's not the way that it is on my plate, so, or on my bowl. So I'm really not going to bother trying to move things around and kind of separate it all out. Because frankly, the reason I eat is for survival. To survive another day so I can fulfill my journey. So I can go one step further. So I can practice the Dhamma one more day. So it really doesn't matter to me what the food in my bowl looks like. The layout of the food, the way that they are placed, it really doesn't matter to me. Now, like I said, it might be difficult for you to do this when you are in a social gathering, you know, when you're in a restaurant and so forth. But when you're at home, imagine it's just your family and you've had this discussion, you've had this chat with your family. Does it really matter where you start eating your food on your plate? Does it? Have a good think. If it doesn't, can you challenge yourself to just start eating wherever your hand touches your food first, or your fork, you know, if you use utensils at home, where your fork or your spoon touch your food first, and then just continue, you know, from whatever's closest to you to whatever's furthest to you. You know, just continue eating until you've completed eating your food. Or when you feel like, you know, that's enough. Because otherwise, you know, you're eating your food and then you bring a bit of papadam, you bring a bit of, you know, all of these curries are around you, on, you know, in your plate, and then you're bringing in bits and pieces and you're mixing it all up. Well, as a monk, I really don't need to do that, because that is not what I eat food for. But hopefully that's giving you some food for thought. So, just going back to the questions we had, someone's commenting saying, I think he's referring to antibiotics, means killing some sort of living being. I saw this posted on Skype. Okay, so I think this is referring back to the to taking medicines and our view as a Buddhist. Now, remember, the Lord Buddha talks about life in this, you know, talks about existence. And he says, Kallan kalla vipakan, sukkan sukka vipakan, kalla sukkan kalla sukka vipakan. What does he mean by that? He says, when we go through samsara, as beings that live in samsara, we, for the purpose of our existence, we do good deeds, good karma, and then we enjoy the consequences of the good karma. We enjoy the rewards, we reap the rewards. We commit sins, we do bad karma, and then we suffer the consequences of bad karma. Now, in the human world, oftentimes what we find is we have no choice. We have little choice but to do both. If you want to survive, if you want to bring purpose and meaning to your life that you've worked really hard to achieve to be born a human being, then you are left with little choice but to, you know, basically stay alive for as long as you've done what you need to do. So, if you're ill, and you know that, for example, you know it's an illness that's caused by bacteria, then what choice do you have but to take an antibiotic? What about when you have worms in your tummy? You know, what choice do you have but to take a wormicide? Because if you didn't, then because you've got to look at it from a pragmatic point of view. You know, Buddhism is not practical, if not pragmatic. You know, there is nothing to Buddhism. Buddhism is nothing else if not pragmatic and practical. Because the Lord Buddha talks about, you know, suffering in samsara. You know, he talks about how we've spent eons and eons in the hells, and how we've struggled so hard, we've fought so hard to become human beings. And today, you know, even having been born human, we commit sins, sometimes which we are unable to control. Sometimes we willingly and knowingly commit sins, and sometimes, you know, unknowingly, you know, things happen. But if you were to think about, you know, I'm ill, what about taking medicines? Oh well, what about shelter? You know, what do you think about when you build a house? You know, you go dig the ground. How many little insects, how many little creatures do you think are harmed when you do that? When you're building a house for yourself? How about when you work on the roads? You know, whether you're wearing shoes or barefooted. How many little animals, how many little insects do you think are killed every day? Simply because you're alive. What about when you breathe? What about all the microbes that live, you know, that survive in the air you breathe? You know, the air that you take in through your nose, you know, these microbes, they go through your nose. You know, some of them get stuck on the way. But sometimes, you know, the moment it comes into contact with your body heat, you know, they die. So what are you supposed to do? Stop breathing? What are you supposed to do? Stop building a house? Or, you know, stop building a shelter for yourself? What about when you put your washing, you know, your dirty laundry in the washing machine? You know, there are little insects, sorry, I keep saying insects, but, you know, there are little microbes, perhaps bacteria, perhaps fungi, you know, these things that come onto clothes and things like that. What about when you clean your home? What about when you sweep dust? You know, sometimes there are ants on the floor. What happens then? So this is the thing, you know. So being a human being, life as a human being falls into the kalla sukkam vipakam bracket. You know, we do good, we enjoy the rewards of the good we do. We sometimes have to commit sins. You know, sometimes you walk on the road and you know that, you know, every time you take a step, you know, it's going to kill animals, but your intention is not to do that. When you take a medicine, your intention is not to kill the, you know, to kill the bacteria, but rather, you know, to be cured. It's just a by, you know, it just happens that the disease is caused by bacteria. And of course, you know that bacteria is going to die when you do this. But what choice do you really have? Do you worry about killing bacteria? Do you worry about, you know, all the microbes that are going to die, and then, you know, just go live under a tree? I mean, even that can be harmful to birds and bees and insects that live, you know, around the tree or on its roots. So there really is no way to stop all of that. You've got to remember that the reason that, you know, these little insects, these bacteria, come into this world, remember, you know, they're not in a sugati, they're not in a blissful plane, they're in the apayas. So they've come into the apayas to suffer. That's not to say, therefore, we should bring suffering to them. And that's not something we need to do. That's something they've brought onto themselves. Just as much as any suffering that you suffer. So, for example, the disease that you have, you know, if you have a disease caused by bacteria, that suffering you've brought onto yourself because of the bad karma that you've done. And just as likely, just as much, you know, the antibacterial medicines you take, that's the vipaka that the bacteria is going to suffer because of the karma that it's done. Now, there are certain religions that try to abstain from lots and lots of things, unlike Buddhists do. So, for example, you know, they don't, you know, they might not drink hot water. Why? Because, you know, they think there are microbes in your mouth, and when you take hot water, you know, that could kill the microbes in your mouth. How far do you go with this? Some people don't, you know, they don't eat potatoes and things that grow in the ground, in the soil, because, you know, digging the soil can kill little animals or little insects. Again, how far do you go with this? This is why the Buddha says, you know, be practical, be pragmatic. Remind yourselves, what is the purpose of your life? How hard have you struggled to achieve what you have? Don't volitionally and deliberately go destroying things and you know, destroying life. But if you want to survive so that you can fulfill your journey, you know, make use of this opportunity that you have and cross the river of this sea of samsara and attain nibbana, you've got to be alive until you do that. And when you're alive, then, you know, it goes back to kalla sukha vipakam. There is no way out of it. This is why he says, attain nibbana as soon as you can. Because for as long as you're alive, beings are, you know, little creatures, little insects, little, you know, animals, big or small, they're going to be hurt. They're going to be harmed. You know, sometimes you, again, you take another example. Sometimes you speak with someone, and you've told them something, and you didn't have the slightest intention to hurt them, but you meet them a week later, and they're really upset with you, and you ask them, hang on, you know, what's changed? What happened? You know, I never thought, and then the person replies, well, I never thought you'd say like something like this to me. I was really hurt. And then you reply, hang on a second, that was not what I intended. That was just something I said, and I never really intended that. So what do you do then? You stop speaking to people altogether? So this is what you need to think. You know, you've got to be practical, you've got to be pragmatic. Otherwise, it's going to be really difficult to fulfill your journey. That is to understand this, the Buddha's teaching, and fulfill your journey in samsara. Okay, I hope that answers that question. Okay, someone's asked, can you please explain the five precepts in depth? I'm happy to do that, but I think that's something we're going to have to cover in a separate program dedicated to that, because, you know, if it's the depth that you want, then we've got to give the depth that it deserves. We've got to give it the time that it deserves. You know, this is the Shastran words, this Dhamma that we're talking here. You know, it's you know, I can't just give meaning, superficial meaning, and then you know, that doesn't do it justice. So what we'll do is we'll actually cover the five precepts in the meaning that aligns to Nibbana in a program on its own. Perhaps that will be next week. Then someone was asking how to explain someone to believe in rebirth. So I think if you Google or just do an internet search on rebirth, there's plenty and shed loads of material on the internet. There are books that have been written on rebirth from a long time ago. You know, books have been written on this subject. You know, a lot of people talk about this subject. A lot of people study, research this, you know, rebirth. Now, in Buddhism, the process of rebirth can be explained through Paticca-samuppada. However, what we've got to understand is to seek material evidence of rebirth, as in, you know, material evidence such as, you know, kind of physical evidence. So, you know, it's like, you know, you go into a laboratory and you perform an experiment using some chemicals. Sometimes you can see for yourself how you know, things happen. Or, you know, let's take a really simple example. If I had a nail in my hand and I want to hammer it, I use a hammer and I start hitting the nail on its head with this hammer, I can see that every time I hit this nail, provided the surface that I'm hitting it onto is soft enough, the nail is going to go in. Okay. Now I don't need faith to believe in that. I can see that for myself. I can see that when I stop hitting it, it stops moving. When I start hitting it again, it starts moving again, and the nail is going to keep going in until perhaps it's going to hit another surface that is not soft enough for the nail to go in any further, or until I've completely hit the nail into the surface. So that doesn't take faith for me to believe in that. However, when it comes to let's take an experiment in a laboratory, a chemical or a chemistry experiment. If you've done chemistry and done experiments in labs, you know how sometimes you've got to draw conclusions, and these conclusions come from hypotheses. And in fact, I'll give you an example. Let's take the example where you have a jar, and into this jar you put a candle. You light this candle, okay, and so you light a candle, you stick it upright on the table, and then you cover this candle with a jar. Now, if it's airtight, I mean, I'm sure we've all done this experiment if you've done this at school. After a few moments, the candle goes out, the fire goes out. So we then draw some deductions and then come to the conclusion that something that was required for the candle to remain lit no longer exists. And then through further experimentation, we understand that that was oxygen. But you didn't see oxygen being consumed. It's not something you sensed through your five senses. But through the power of deduction, through intelligence and intelligent thought, you pick up the fact that, well, something's being consumed. And I think sometimes, you know, you fill this jar up with water and you see that the water level has moved up. So you tie those two observations together and you say something's been consumed and that has been taken up by something else. So fire requires, well, something to stay lit. And then after further experimentation, you understand that that is oxygen. Now, rebirth, until you experience it for yourself, and I don't mean by being reborn. What I mean is by either being able to recall experiences from your past life, and you know there are lots of stories of that, again on the internet, you know, even in almost all countries, really. You know, there are lots of stories of how young boys and girls relate stories of their previous lives, okay, So you either experience that yourself firsthand, or you attain, you develop your mind, and you attain these supernatural powers whereby you can cast your mind back to previous lives, which is called Putte Nivasanu Satinyane. To be able to see where your past births were. Now, if you've developed your mind to the fourth jhana, then at that point you are able to focus your mind on that particular power. And then when you cultivate that mental power, that's something you get. It becomes a faculty. You can then reflect on your previous births. So unless you do one of these two, the evidence for rebirth really comes in the fact that when you listen to stories of how, for example, young children relate stories from their previous birth, how sometimes they've been in an accident, or perhaps they were in the war, or how they talk about things that there's absolutely no other way they could have known about. They lived with absolutely no attachment or no connection to this other place or the other person that they're relating to, or they're talking about a time that was way, way, way before they were born, and sometimes they even have skills and talents that that surprises us, that makes us wonder how is it that for example, take Beethoven, and how he could play music at the age of 7, at such a young age he could play masterpieces. So how did he have that power? And makes you wonder whether it's something that they've cultivated from a previous existence. And then once you rule out the possibilities, whatever remains has got to be the truth. So when you take these examples, and there are plenty of these stories online, so I'm not going to relate any stories, I'm not going to read out any stories. You please go online and just Google rebirth stories, and there are many popular non-Buddhist scientists in the world, such as Edgar Cayce and people like that, who have experimented or who have researched on this subject to a great extent. To be fair, I haven't done as much research, but what they're finding is that when you weigh up the evidence and you then try and relate back to all of the possible causes, because ultimately it's got to be cause and effect, right? There's nothing that doesn't fall into the cause and effect theory, not theory but rather axiom. It's not a theory to be disproved. It is a reality, cause and effect, except for Nibbana. Okay, everything else is cause and effect. So when you have weighed up all of the other possibilities and you've discarded them, whatever remains, no matter how unlikely, has got to be the truth. And I think there was a famous scientist who said that before. And if I'm not mistaken, that's Einstein, who said once you've discarded all of the, once you looked at all of the possibilities, probabilities even, and you rejected everything that is not possible, whatever remains, however unlikely, has got to be the truth. So when you do that with these stories, the only possible, the only plausible explanation that remains is rebirth. Now, some people might be uncomfortable with accepting that as solid evidence to prove to them that rebirth exists. Well, the point, if that is the point that they have, then my question to them, or my comment to them is, well, that's okay, so why bother? Don't worry yourself so much about rebirth. If it's a concept that you're struggling to grasp, if it doesn't sit comfortably with you, if you're thinking there isn't enough sufficient evidence for you to believe in rebirth, that's okay. Put it to a side. Don't worry about it just now. There are plenty more issues to worry about. What about your day-to-day existence, right? What about all the raga dvesha moha that you need to quench your lust, your desires, your anger, your delusion? Let's worry about these things, because these things that make us suffer in this birth alone, without having to worry about the next birth. I always talk about expectation and disappointment. Expectation and disappointment, this is not something that's going to disappoint us in the next birth. This is something that disappoints us in this birth. So have you done everything you need to do about setting expectations and then being disappointed? If you have, then you can start worrying about rebirth. Well, if you haven't, and this is what I said at the beginning, when you've got bigger fish to fry, let's not worry about the small fry, because there are bigger problems to solve. in this birth itself, you know, there's plenty of suffering, there's plenty of disappointment, there's plenty of frustration that we need to worry about, that we need to try and, well, not worry about, but to try and treat, to try and find a cure to. Well, the cure has been prescribed. The problem is we don't apply it. The problem is we're not taking the medication that has so clearly been laid out in front of us. Well, let's start doing that. You know, this is not a... I'm not having a go at anybody. Please don't get me wrong. But I know there are some people that find it difficult, and you know, they're not satisfied until they can see material, physical evidence to prove something. And if that is the case, as far as I know, that's not something you're going to find. Not yet, anyway. That has not been... there is nothing that is available today to kind of prove at that level that rebirth, the concept of rebirth exists, or the rebirth phenomenon is true. You've got to take it with an element of faith, but you've also got to think, you know, you've also got to try and think, at least the way I related previously, which is when you look at some of these stories, when you look at examples of where people talk about rebirth, and you then discard all of the other facts and as untrue, whatever remains, no matter how disagreeable you find it, it's got to be the truth.